accession number 17744, wheel 1.
Mr. Cam, reel 1, where were you born?
Eastrington.
Which year was this?
1922.
Did you grow up in the East Riding and have your schooling there?
Yes, in Hull.
Which school did you go to?
Thomas Stratton, it's an elementary school in...
How old were you when you left there?
14.
Did you get a job?
I can't remember what I did now.
What job were you doing when war was declared?
I was with a transport company called C.A. and F. Cook Haulage Company.
Driving?
Yes. Well, I was learning to be a driver.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did, yes.
And what was your reaction to that?
Well, at the time we were bringing sand into Hull for the people to make sandbags to protect the city. And we stopped at this public house for a meal and heard it on the radio.
Did you feel dismayed or excited or what?
No, just disappointed that we were going to have a war, but just accepted it as something that was going to happen.
Did you think it was going to last long?
No, we knew. Nobody knew.
Were you in any early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
Yes, in Hull, in 8th of May 1941. That was the heaviest raid on Hull, and I was in the city centre, sheltering from the raid. And the next morning I saw the fires and the damage and the people being, casualties being taken away. And it really was a very bad raid. I think that probably gave me the idea of joining the Air Force and becoming a bomber commander.
Where was the air raid shelter?
In Wilcombe Lee.
Why had you used that?
That was the company where the company C.A. and F. Cook. That was their, I'd been visiting them, and that was their garage.
Whereabouts on Wilcombe Lee was it?
Bromley Street.
Were there many people in the shelter?
About half a dozen.
What did it feel like in the shelter?
No, we just accepted those things in those days. You're a little cautious when you heard a screaming bomb, etc., but you just accepted it as something that was happening. Nobody panicked.
Did any bombs come near to the shelter?
Yes, some quite near. A large factory near the bridge, one of the bridges was blown up. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was quite a big flour mill, I think it was.
Is this near Northbridge?
Somewhere near there, yes.
How did public morale stand up in Hull to the bombing?
They just accepted it as something was happening. Nobody panicked, it was just took it as it went.
Did it make anybody want to come to an agreement to end the war?
Not that I know.
Do you remember any other streets or buildings that were hit in Hull?
Oh, yes, the whole centre was absolutely devastated. It was the major raid on Hull. Hammond's and the Paragon Square and the cinemas, and the centre of Hull was really badly hit.
What did you think of the performance of the emergency services?
Very good.
Was there any hatred of the German air crews who were carrying out the bombing?
None whatsoever.
Why do you think that was?
Well, they didn't hate us, I don't think. When we did in Hull, people don't realise that in Hull, during the whole war, we lost 1,200 people. On some raids I participated in on the Ruhr and Berlin, we killed 4,000 people in one night. And we had no animosity towards the German people, only the Nazis.
What was your address in Hull?
Lonsborough Street.
Actually,
next to the school, Sir Thomas Stratton School.
Did any bombs fall in that area?
Yes, there's quite a few.
Do you remember any specific ones?
Oh, no, I can't remember now. But quite a few were dropped around there.
So how did you come to join the RAF yourself?
I volunteered. I saw an advert in the paper wanting aircrew. I immediately volunteered. It was in shortly after the raid.
Did you go to a recruiting station in Hull?
No, I wrote up to the people that were advertising. I forgot where it was now, but I wrote and I got. I was sent for an interview and a medical, etc., and accepted.
Had you been motivated by the idea of revenge?
No, not at all.
What was?
It was just a duty to do.
About what was the date that you applied to join?
It was 41, mid-41, shortly after the raid.
Where were you trained?
In the actual training, you know, for aircrew, was Blackpool. And most, I was accepted as a wireless operator, air gunner. And I was sent to Blackpool to do my training, to learn Morse.
What did you think of the quality of the training that you received?
Oh, exceptional. Very good.
Did you have any problems with it?
No.
Which part of the training did you prefer, the wireless side or the air gunnery side?
Oh, there was no air gunnery side at Blackpool. You had to become... There was no such things as straight air gunners in those days. You had to be a wireless operator air gunner. And we went up to 10, 12 words a minute at Blackpool, and then you were due to be posted down south to receive the transmitting side of it. You're only receiving at Blackpool. And you had to go down south to learn about the radio stations and how to transmit, etc. And then having passed that, there was a short course for an air gunner, I suppose, and then you were a wireless operator air gunner.
Whereabouts down south was it?
I can't remember offhand now, Wing or some name like that. I can't remember. But when I was in the doing this course, we'd got up to 10, 12 words a minute. And there's quite a number of us were called into a room to be met by a senior Air Force officer. And he thanked us for volunteering to become rear gunners, which we hadn't, of course, but he thanked us for volunteering. And within 2 or 3 days, we were off the wireless operators course and were posted to Dalcross in Scotland, where they had Defiance. There were 3 Polish pilots there. They were called Zablocki, Walzo, and Tyron Dabrowski. And they were instructors on Defiant aeroplanes and bolt and pole turrets. And in a matter of weeks, plus 10.5 hours flying, we were sergeant rear gunners, as quick as that. And someone casually said, well, had we been asked to volunteer, we would have done so. But that's how we became rear gunners. And then from there we went to Lossiemouth, that's in Scotland, to have what is called an OTU, Operational Training Unit, and to be crewed up with other navigators, pilots, bomb aimers, etc., to form a crew and do what is called operational training unit, which we did.
How did you crew up?
Pardon?
How?
The pilots more or less met everyone in the mess and round the camp and took a liking to someone, How would you like to be my rear gunner? How would you like to be my wireless operator? There's no specific. And I was chosen by a very experienced pilot called P.O. Mason. And although he hadn't done any operational flying, he was an experienced pilot. And I was very pleased and proud to be his rear gunner.
Who else was in the crew?
I can't remember the names. Aitken was a bomb aimer. We had two or three navigators because something went wrong. And that's... we had a pilot, navigator, wireless operator, and rear gunner. Oh, and bomb aimer, of course. There's only five in the crew. We were, at this time, at Driffield, near Hull, there was a squadron being called 466 RAAF, flying Wellingtons that we were training in. And they had just been formed and moved to Leconfield. And we joined them at Leconfield on Wellingtons.
Did you think that was a good method of crewing up?
Oh, yes, yes. You had to be a team.
Were all the crew English?
Yes, my crew, first crew, yes, all English. At one stage we had a New Zealand, this was on Halifax, we had a New Zealand bomb aimer. In fact, I finished flying later on Halifax with a New Zealand pilot.
Was there much difference between the English and the New Zealanders?
Not at all. When we got to Leconfield, the pilots, incoming crews, the pilots of these incoming crews were sent on what is called a second dicky trip. That means a second pilot to go as a second pilot on the trip to gain experience before they took their own crews. And unfortunately, P.O. Mason went to Cologne with a flight lieutenant, Kirk, and they were attacked and shot up, and they were killed. My first pilot, he only lasted 3 or 4 days on the squadron. And it was only, donkey's years after the war, I bumped into the rear gunner, who still writes to me even today in 1997, and he told me what happened. They were going down in flames, and Kirk and Mason, they were the two pilots, held this Wellington, which was blazing, till the rest of the crew got out. And unfortunately, only two of them did manage to get to the escape hatch. And one of these, Norman Leonard, he was one of them that still writes to me. He, of course, was a prisoner of war till the end of the war. And my poor pilot only lasted 3 or 4 days. The photograph I have there was of where they found this remains of this aircraft, and the tailplane is now in Moorhut, where the names of the crews and the dates they went in are there. And it's a memorial now to two very brave pilots.
When did you join 466 Squadron?
Late January 43.
And that was at Leconfield?
Leconfield, yes.
What was Leconfield like to operate from?
Perfect, wonderful station, wonderful people in the village that really welcomed us. And we only had Wellingtons there then, but later we converted onto Halifaxes. And then after we converted onto Halifaxes, 466 moved to Driffield, and a new squadron was formed called 640 Squadron. And my pilot, Lindsay Reynolds, DFC, who took us over when Mason was killed, he became the first flight commander. But all our trips on the Wellington days were the roar, Dwiesbell, Dusnow, Arkham, Munchen, Gladbeck, Essen, all the road trips.
What was it like working and living inside the Wellington bomber?
Nothing, just accepted it. It was, the turret was not much bigger than an armchair. You used to put your oxygen mask on at 10,000 feet. In no, absolutely enclosed in a perspex little turret. And you used to go up to 16, 18,000 feet, and sometimes in temperatures as low as 30 degrees. It was very, very cold. You used to wear leather jackets and heating overalls, or like overalls you put on that you could heat up under your leather flying jacket. The front window, the observation hatch in the front, we didn't have one. It was open to the sea, open to the elements.
Did the aircrew have any superstitions or lucky charms or anything of that kind?
None whatsoever. No.
Do any of the operations stand out in your mind in the Wellington?
Yes, there's one on the... we're returning, I think, with Frankfurt, coming home from Frankfurt, I think it was. We had a collision. A fighter, I think it was April 43, I think. We had a fighter, Junkers 88, hit us more or less head on, and his wing, there's the tailplane, his wing chopped off about 3 foot of our tailplane. Of course, he went down, and we just dived to the earth. And the pilot, I think that is probably the main reason he got the DFC for pulling it out of the crash and bringing it home. And I think it was 10 years afterwards that it dawned on me what had happened. At the time, I just accepted it as a collision. Like two cars or two buses colliding. But it was some 10 years later, after the war, I was laid in bed half asleep, and it suddenly dawned on me how far were these propellers from me. They could have chopped me up into slices of bacon. It was 10 years after the war that I realised how near it was.
What did it feel like when the planes collided?
Well, it was all over in a second. I mean, we'd be doing 250 miles an hour and he'd be coming in at least that. And it was just bang and all over.
What was the flak like over the Ruhr?
Oh, exceptionally heavy. Yeah. We used to joke about it in the mess when they asked what it was like. We used to say, just joking this, of course, we used to say, we could put the undercarriage down and taxi across it. I was just joking, of course, but it was very, very heavy. Far, far, far heavier than you ever saw in England or London. You're passing over so many towns together. There's Essen, Dresden, München, Glemmet, Bochum, Düsseldorf, Duisburg, and you're passing over them so many times, and they're all firing at you.
What did the flak look like?
Well, it's just flak. It's just... I'll tell you one thing I've never mentioned before. It was we took a flak major with us once. He was an army man. I think he was army. And it was his job to estimate the height and the density of the flak. And he used to sit in the observer's tower and... I always remember him saying to the pilot, oh, look over there, let's get into that. And he used to move and he used to check the strength of the flak. He was an absolutely crazy man. He did about 5 trips until he bought it. And he used to come back and, you know, to give the height of the density of the flak and the power explosions, etc. And I forgot his name now, but he eventually bought it. And he was a very brave man, and I say he did about 5 or 6 trips doing this, so that in the mess you could have a chart with the height and the density of the flak to be expected.
And he was called a flak major?
Yes, that was his nickname, but there was only the one person, the only one off. And I don't know who he worked for, but he was certainly there. I'd like to have known, you know, his history, because he was a very, very brave man. And you've seen charts of the different height of the flak like that, and he was the one that used to be there with a stopwatch and little camera doing it all. And he used to like us to fly into something. And it was absolutely crazy. And so eventually bought it. I'd love to know his name and what happened to him.
Was he RAF or Army?
I think he was Army, I'm not sure. I don't quite know. I know we called him the Flak Major. Possibly he was. He was only around for a few months.
So a major referred to his rank?
Yes, may have done, yeah.
Presumably.
Just his nickname, yeah.
Was there any sense of dread when you knew you had to go to the Ruhr again?
Not at all. Just accepted it. Just a trip. I mean, every other trip for us in 43, it was the heaviest bombing period, I think, of them all, was 43, when every other trip was the Ruhr.
Were there colleagues in the squadron who couldn't take it, who couldn't take the strain and stress?
No, never met one. I believe there were some, but if there were odd ones, that they were silently posted, but there was no song and dance about it. Our CEO there, the station commander, was a marvellous man. The group captain Wardhouse, he died quite recently. And he used to come and... He died quite recently. And he used to come into the mess. Occasionally we have some big drinking sessions, of course, you know, and whining. And I always remember him coming into the mess during one of these sessions, and he... a vase there of daffodils. And he picked one of these daffodils, about two actually, came up to me and says, "How many of these, Cam?" Very, very nice. And he ate his, so, to show the flag, I had to eat a daffodil. And that's the type of man he was. And I said, "Oh, thank you very much, very, very nice." And that's the type of man Waterhouse was, you know, a wonderful man.
But what did you normally do for relaxation when you were not on a raid?
Drink. We had a football team and never played, but mainly we were flying nearly all the time. We had three trips a week on occasions.
What kind of alcohol did you drink?
Beer, just ordinary beer. Nothing getting really blind drunk, but sing-song and people on the piano and what have you.
Did anybody drink before they went on an operation?
No, that was taboo.
What could you see of the target as you were bombing?
Well, being a railgun, I couldn't see anything till we were over it. But the bomb aimers, of course, they could see the target. And it's just a red glow. You know, I have photographs of it somewhere. It's just a red glow. You've seen pictures of it, just a red glow. And by the time I got there, looking down from the rear turret, it was more or less on the edge of it.
Did you feel that you were hitting the target?
Oh, yes, yes. We were very, very conscientious. We had, towards the end, they brought out PFF, where mosquitoes used to go in, and suppose they were going for one certain part of the city that was industrial or oil mills or something of that nature, they used to go down very, very low, earmark it, and drop flares. Another one used to drop a flare in line with it, so when we came up, we weren't dropping on the city, we were bombing a flare that went past this flare into the target. And these mosquitoes, PFF mozzies, as we call them, you could hear them saying, "Oh, left, left, right, right, over to the left of it, lads, over to the left." And they were going down to see the area being absolutely devastated, and guiding us to you know, to overshoot a little or to the left or to the right, port or starboard, and undershoot till the whole area was absolutely flattened what we'd gone to bomb. And they're very, very good men, those PFF Mosquitoes. I heard one on one occasion saying this, I think it was Schweinfurt or Stuttgart somewhere, Mannheim somewhere, a long trip away, and he was giving his ritual, left, left, you're overshooting, that's fine, hold it there, doing fine, deathly silence. Come in number two, you're overshooting, he'd gone in. And the other one, he was talking all the time to, he stopped like that, and a moment later, come in number two, and number two came in, that says he was going down to his death, come in number two, and the other mosquito, you're overshooting, overshooting, to your left, and it's all over, finish. And you know, we got the part we're going to. Very, very brave men, those Mozzie PFF lads. And they absolutely pinpointed the target.
Did you have any duels with any German fighters?
Oh, yes, I got... apart from this collision, the other one I was in... When I finished on Halifax's, I went on to Lancaster's at the end of the war. And right at the end with another crew, a new crew I joined up with, and we were attacked by a Messerschmitt. I did hit it. I saw... the damage, but I didn't see the pilot bail out and I didn't see it crash through the clouds, so I didn't claim it as a kill, but I certainly hit it.
That was when you were doing a Lancaster operation?
Lancaster operation, yeah.
Which squadron would that have been with?
106 squadron.
Do you remember which city you were raiding then?
No, I can't remember which it was. Flensburg, I think. Either Flensburg or Nordhausen, somewhere like that. It was right at the end of the war.
Going back to 466, you said it was Royal Australian Air Force.
Yeah.
Was there any strong Australian characteristic to it?
You know, when 466 was formed, there was only a handful of Australians on the squadron. Most of us were English. And they gradually started coming in, and towards the end, on Wellington's, about 50% would be Australian. When they went over to Driffield on Halifax's, the majority were Australians. But the early days were mostly English, even though it was called RAAF.
Were they much different in character from the English?
No, wonderful people.
Did you have any preference for the Wellington, the Halifax or the Lancaster?
Oh, the Wellington. Wellington's my airplane.
Why was that?
It always came home. It was just geodetic construction with fabric around the top, but it was, to me, it's the most wonderful aeroplane that's ever flown.